This is Bootstrapped Web, episode number 59. This is the podcast for you, the founder who learns by doing as you bootstrap your business online. And today, we're talking about validation. How to know if the idea you have in mind is actually a business worth pursuing. I am Jordan.
And I'm Brian.
Excellent. This is a topic that comes up all the time, whether it's experienced entrepreneurs looking into a new idea or first-time entrepreneurs trying to mitigate their risk into, you know, going into a bad idea. So it's a great topic, one we get asked about often.
Yeah, totally. And I think it is on everybody's mind, you know, continuously. And it's one of those things that, like, you hear a lot of different teachings on this and different methods and popular frameworks and whatnot. And then still, even when you consume all these different books, like the Lean Startup and all these other, you know, other things, when it comes down to it and comes into practice, it's still like a hazy mess of like, is this really valid? Or am I taking the right next step here? I'm not really sure. Is this really worth my time, or am I wasting money or time here? So it's just a big question mark, and hopefully we'll try to unpack it a little bit here today.
That's right. And before we get into it and talking about those different frameworks and kind of running through our own framework, an amalgamation of all those things and our personal experiences, why don't we get a little bit of an update? Brian, last week you were lost in the snow. Tell us about that.
Oh man, last week was awesome. I got back from Big Snow Tiny Conf up at Sugarbush, Vermont. This was the second year that we've done it, and this year still not everyone was able to make it. Unfortunately, we had 12 people registered. 10 people actually made it. But it was a really, really great group. Bunch of fellow online entrepreneurs just talking business. We each kind of gave our own talks. We call them attendee talks. Everybody kind of prepares a little discussion with the group. And just, you know, three nights, you know, spend half the day out on the mountain snowboarding and skiing, and the other half hanging out and doing these talks. And oh man, it's a really great group when everybody's participating and everyone's really helping each other out. And like, I came away from it with actual changes and like actionable things that I was starting to do something. And thanks to the feedback that I got from the group, I actually made a few tweaks in my plans. And I think a lot of the other people at the trip had the same takeaway from it. So that was really cool. And there was like a massive blizzard while we were there. So it was probably the best snowboarding conditions I've ever had on the East Coast of the US, which is saying a lot because the East Coast usually sucks. But it was amazing, just pure powder the whole way. And it was awesome.
Nice. You guys got lucky. Yeah, and there's definitely a big difference between reading something online and processing it as, oh, maybe I should change my approach to something. And then being in person with people that you know and like and trust, and they give you the advice, you're much more likely to take action on it.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. You know
that, and Sugarbush just sounds so inviting.
Yeah, you know, just the name. Yeah,
just take me to Sugarbush.
Well, that's right.
That's great, man.
And you know, the other thing about this trip is that it was kind of like a retreat. Although I was with other people basically the whole time, I did have some time to kind of reflect and have some like a personal retreat and think about the larger goals for the year. And that actually got my wheels turning a bit, a bit of a scary direction, I guess you could say, but it's something that's been on my mind for a while. And that is just thinking long and hard about what I'm going to be working on next, you know, after Restaurant Engine, or maybe alongside Restaurant Engine, and once Restaurant Engine is fully kind of running itself, which I think it's on its way there, pretty close. In terms of like my goals for the year, I'm starting to maybe even reassess some of the things there and start to explore something new. I mean, sooner rather than later. So my original idea was to finish out the year starting to transition into what's next. But now I'm thinking, you know what, if I'm planning to go into something new anyway, why shouldn't I start get the ball rolling now? And I do have a couple different ideas, one particular that I'm actually very excited about, that I'm getting the ball rolling on talking to customers and going through this validation process. I'm sure I'll share a lot more details about what all this is about in the coming weeks. Maybe we'll see, but, you know, for now I'm just making plans, figuring out the first steps to get it out of my head and start talking to people. And we will see about where this goes.
Right, so this validation discussion is very relevant, and I love these beginning conversations that I think I have an idea, I might do this, and I love that it's documented in this podcast, because look, if it doesn't go anywhere, then we can ignore this, but if it does get somewhere and it, you know, has a big impact on your life, you can kind of look back at the beginning of it very, very fondly. So it's very, very exciting.
Yeah. It is exciting. It's a little unnerving, because I know that in the past I've struggled with shiny object syndrome, as most of us do.
Yes.
And I've gotten into different things that I later kind of, you know, regret because I lost focus. But this time I do feel it's a little bit different, because I'm not necessarily thinking about doing things simultaneously, although there will be some of that. I'm really thinking about like transitioning from one thing to the next thing, just the same way that I transitioned from freelance consulting into building, you know, my first kind of SaaS. And then now it's like, all right, maybe this into the next thing.
So very cool.
Anyway, we'll see how that goes. But, yeah, Jordan, what is up on your end?
Nothing too exciting, but, I guess the only thing I would want to mention, last week, I really enjoyed the show that we did on product versus marketing and where to focus and how that time gets split up, and it's a difficult thing to manage. I guess one thing that we didn't touch on there, you know, the boring side of things is working on the business. And that's not product and it's not marketing, and it's a lot of the things that, I don't know about you, I would prefer to ignore these things as much as possible, but they do have to be done. And over the past few weeks, I have spent a lot of time on logistics and lawyers and legal documents and getting things in order. You know, I ran Cardhook out of my S Corp for a long time. And now as things start to kind of get more interesting and more formal, let's say, I spun it out into its own corporation. So went through the process with the lawyers and getting IP transferred over and just kind of getting all these things in order. It's not really that much fun.
No.
But it does.
I hate that stuff.
me too. Accounting, and you know, it's annoying, but it's unbelievably important.
Oh yeah.
If you get things wrong, you will regret it. If you get things right, you will be very happy. So yeah, so it's product versus marketing. That's where we like to focus. That's the creative side of things, and it's interesting, and this other side is less so. But I did want to bring it up. It's just kind of been on my mind. You know, I've been emailing with lawyers as much as I have been with customers over the past few weeks.
Yeah, exactly. Like the product and the marketing are things that we constantly want to push on. We either want to push on product or want to push on marketing. And the business is kind of that other thing that needs to be pushed on, but kind of pushes on us. Like, all right, you got to take a break today and work on something that you got to eat your veggies too.
Yeah. But these are the things that actually make a huge difference down the line.
Yep.
You know, if Cardhook eventually gets acquired, a lot of that will have to do with the fact that the company owns this IP and that IP and this trademark and this piece of technology that was developed. And so getting those things buttoned up is hugely important. It's just annoying. You don't want to do it now.
Yeah.
Yep. It's just part of the deal, wearing, you know, all the hats when you do this on your own or when you just do it with very few people.
Yeah. I mean, like this week and also last month, I spent quite a bit of time, like several days, transitioning into starting to use Xero to manage my accounting and books. And that took me a while just to set it up and get all the rules right and connect my bank accounts and all that. And now this week, I started to kind of reconcile my first month of the year and you know, kind of doing it myself. And then didn't take me long to start, interviewing potential bookkeepers. So, mm-hmm. You know, that's always fun.
Cool. But, yeah. I've been looking into that. I saved bench.co.
Yeah.
bookkeeping service, very, very cool.
Yeah, I've had my eye on that. I'm pretty set up with Xero right now, so I'm kind of comparing different people in terms of like, you know, like Xero certified bookkeepers or whatever.
Oh, I see. I see. So, right, so Xero, you know, gets things organized, but a bookkeeper, what, like consolidates and makes sure it's formalized.
Yeah, I mean, like Xero is the software, and then the bookkeeper would kind of handle the monthly reconciliation. And maybe run some reports and get everything buttoned up and delivered over to my accountant, you know, for the taxes and all that. So.
Yeah. All right. I just need to apologize for that update. We just lost half of our viewership. Let's
get out of the accounting
talk and
get into the good stuff. All right.
Cool.
We don't actually have any new iTunes reviews. So if you are listening and you're enjoying this, stop your car, take out your phone, go to iTunes, leave us a 5-star review. We'd really appreciate it.
come on, baby. Make it happen. All right, so let's get into the topic.
Yep.
Validation, right? This is the mythical unicorn of avoiding all risk of starting a new business or a new product and knowing for sure that it's going to work and having paying customers before you do anything and all this other stuff. But you know, what does it look like in real life?
Yeah. Totally. I just want to start this off by like, I receive a lot of these emails from people and there's nothing wrong with this, but like, you know, kind of pitching an idea or even, you know, like from friends, you know, pitching an idea, like, would you pay for that? You know, like, here's the idea. It seems like you have this problem. Like, is that something you would pay for? And I know what's happening there. Obviously you're trying to validate something, but I don't think that alone is validation. I think a lot of people would say that really is, it's like just hearing someone tell you yes or no, I would pay for that or not pay for that does not make it fully valid. And the way that I look at all of this is it's really a progression. Like it's a multi-step process, and every step it gets a little bit more validated. It's not a binary thing. It's more of like a percentage thing. Like you get more and more confident as you progress from step one to step two to step three. And I guess we'll kind of run through this whole progression in a minute, but first, you know, what are like the known frameworks for validation and how do they differ?
Yeah, so we've got a few of them listed here. And I agree with you that it's doubtful that you'll have absolutely everything buttoned up on the validation, that there's a market and there's a problem and people need a solution and they're willing to pay and people have given you money and you've showed them the mock-ups and they like it and they're put money in your pocket, right? That's unlikely that you'll get everything. But there is like a tipping point. There is some point where you say, you know what? I have these data points. I have enough reason to be confident in pursuing it.
Yep.
So some known frameworks. The big guy in the room, that's the lean startup, and that's hypothesis tested with an MVP and then iterated on quickly, yep. Measured and iterated on, which to me sounds fantastic and scientific and all that. It just requires resources that I know myself and most of the people listening here do not have.
Yeah. And I think every one of these known frameworks has a few holes in it that makes it, I think they're all really useful, and we should take a lot from all of them, really. And I think that's what we do here today. But there are also things to keep in mind, like why, you know, you can't necessarily follow every one of these to the letter and expect to have success 100% of the time. So yeah, lean startup, that's the big one. Everyone kind of knows, you know, about that by now, probably. You know, start with like a hypothesis, an idea, and then. Develop some kind of MVP, and maybe that also means like delivering an MVP manually, which I think is a great idea.
Yep.
But anyway, that's the lean startup. And then, I mean, the other big one is 30 by 500, you know, Amy Hoy's popular course for bootstrappers.
Right.
I don't think we haven't gone through that at all, but we're, you know, somewhat familiar with the concept, and that is like the idea of sales safari, which from what I understand is kind of doing research, watching potential customers, quote unquote, like in their own habitat as they act in the wild, like not necessarily doing the customer interviews, because that can often be a little bit biased, or customers don't exactly say exactly what they mean. Whereas Sales Safari, when you're watching the questions that they're asking in forums or in reviews or in different places, you're getting a sense for where is the need here and what is the problem that needs to be solved. And I'm sure there's obviously a lot more to it than just that, but that's the general concept.
Yeah, that's what I see as the argument for the Sales Safari 30 by 500 approach, that it's easier to be successful in building a product if you can find people, real people out there on the internet that are already experiencing the problem, that they're complaining about it, that they're looking for a solution, as opposed to coming up with an idea and saying, who would find my idea valuable? Let me go talk to them and see if they would find my idea valuable.
Right.
Right. It's going the other way. It's going, why not see where there already exists demand for a solution?
Yeah.
So I think that's valid. And there are tactical ways to do that, from forums and message boards to email lists to, you know, all types of stuff. I do that stuff regularly. I'll log into BigCommerce in the forums, and I'll do a search for abandoned cart, and I'll see what people are saying about BigCommerce's built-in abandoned cart app to see if I should build an integration for BigCommerce or not bother. Are people happy about the existing BigCommerce abandoned cart or not? So this is, yeah, I think it's a great framework, and I think it's an especially great framework and course for developers who are not good at sales marketing yet.
Yeah. Yep. I mean, I've heard one argument against it is that it's almost like it keeps you too much in your comfort zone of not getting out there and talking to people and making those face-to-face sales. And not necessarily that you have to do face-to-face sales in order to be successful, but
at some point
you have to get yourself out of the comfort zone. And I find it a little bit of a stretch to think that just identifying, some what you see out there online in forums can guarantee the right idea at the right time for the right customer. I'm sure there's a lot more to it than that, but
right. I'm not sure if we're being fair to it.
I mean, I think there's also your own bias as you approach that, right? Like, if I have an idea for something, any question that I notice related to this idea is going to be like, I've got my eye out for that. So it's like you're kind of going to grab things that may influence you, like have a heavier influence than they should.
Right. Yeah. I ignore all things that are contradictory to my worldview or approach to the product. And I emphasize the ones that are in line with it. But I'm not sure if we're being 100% fair to 30 by 500 because we're just not that familiar with it. Yes. I assume, and this is something that we'll get into, that talking to real people has to be part of it. But if you can use the Sales Safari process to identify a problem, and then when you do approach people, you have a specific problem in mind, then I think those two can marry, well.
Totally. I think we should definitely take pieces from all of this stuff.
Yep.
And then the third, of course, is Foundation, which, you're more familiar with it.
Yeah. Yeah. Foundation from Dane Maxwell. It always felt a little bit to me like Dane kind of reverse engineered his luck in some way, but we have to give him credit for being aware enough in that situation, right? So Dane was doing a bunch of different things around real estate, and he was very aggressive and good about talking to people on the phone. And so one person that he spoke with on the phone, a broker, basically said, look, I don't need that. I don't need what you're offering, but what I do need is this. And what he mentioned there is what became Paperless Pipeline, which is Dane's most successful software product. And I guess the concept
is like idea extraction, which is like not even like really the customer is telling you what they want you to build.
Right. And so, right. That's how I looked at Dane's experience, but he was aware enough to basically look at his success and how that happened and basically say, I was wrong to go into this conversation with my own idea for a business, my own solution. The right way to do it, the one he developed in the foundation, is the idea extraction, to go in maybe with a hunch, but without without your own ego saying, this is the product I want to build. Really just being open to it and exploring their difficulties, their problems, their typical day, where their pain is, and then doing that around a specific industry and letting the patterns come up. And then once you do identify something that's relatively widespread that can be solved with software, then going back to those people and pre-selling, which I think is the idea extraction is really the best part of the foundation process. But the second piece of it is pre-selling. And that is, can you get people to pay you money? Can you get multiple people to give you money before you build the app? Because that shows a sign of it's such a severe pain that they're so excited about potentially having it solved that you're dealing with something that has a lot of pent-up demand. And so when you build it, when you go through the pain and money of building it, you are most likely to come out with a success.
Yeah. And I agree. I think the pre-selling piece is, you know, not that it's impossible or that, you know, it's just that I think it's a little bit of a stretch in so many cases, you know, and I think the reason for that is, like, even if you're hitting on the right pain and the right problem, right solution for the right person, there are a lot of people in this world who are happily willing to pay for that. They just don't want to pay for it in a pre-selling format, you know?
Right.
They just want to pay for it when it's ready.
Yes, but the theory is if you can get some people to pay you ahead of time, then you'll get plenty of people to pay you when it's ready.
Okay.
It's really more of an indicator, right?
But you still have to find those people who happen to have that characteristic of being okay with being like a super early adopter.
And yes, the secret to that is that in the idea extraction process, you get to know people, you build personal relationships with people, and they grow to trust you. So when you do say, hey, this is what I'm considering building, here are screenshots of what I'm going to build, would you pay for this? Are you willing to pay for this now? You're not coming out of the blue and trying to pre-sell someone. It's gotcha. Someone you've spoken to over the past few weeks and they know you. Yeah, it's the ideal. The truth is you don't see it done often, the actual pre-selling and collection of money ahead of time, but it is a good ideal to go for.
Yep. Cool. So why don't we go through kind of this process and, you know, how would I frame this? Basically, I broke down a bunch of like steps in this validation process. And of course, everything here is taken from different parts of these known frameworks that we've just discussed. And, you know, a lot from my own experience and your own experience as well, and just getting a feel for it. So the way that I'm framing this up is, every step gets you a certain percentage farther along this validation spectrum, right? And so at each one of these steps, there are a few actions that you can take. And really, there's a key question that you're trying to answer in each individual step. And that answer will give you or not give you the confidence to move on to the next step and get that scale from 10% to 20% to 30% validated.
Right.
So it's not like a yes or no, is this validated? It's like how far along are we on this scale?
Right. Is this particular stage in my favor or not? You know, how many of these stages do I want to be in my favor before I say, yes, this is a good idea? Or you know, how many of them are red flags that tell me don't mess with this?
Yep.
Yeah. So where does it start?
So, you know, obviously I think it starts with an idea and, you know, personally, my take on this is that the idea, you can call it a hunch, you can call it a fully fleshed out idea of your own, but it kind of starts internally. And by that, I mean, really one of two things. Number A, it's a scratch your own itch. Like, I experienced this problem, this pain, I want to solve it for myself. And in fact, I want to explore the idea of solving it for myself and then making a product out of it that possibly other people experience. That's one version of this.
Right.
But the other version would be, you know, I don't necessarily experience the pain myself, but I see a problem out there and I see a real opportunity to solve it. I mean, in my own experience, this scratch your own itch, that I've done that plenty of times. You know, one thing comes to mind is WP Bids, a WordPress theme that I developed a couple of years back. I wanted, as a freelance web designer, I wanted to create proposals, nice looking proposals, using my own design through WordPress. and I didn't want to use Word or Google Docs, and I didn't want to use a SaaS. I wanted to just have my own WordPress site and create a proposal for my clients. So I developed a WordPress theme to do that, which I used myself for many years, and then I packaged it up and sold it as a product. The other piece, like seeing a problem and trying to solve it for someone else, of course, would be Restaurant Engine. I mean, I was involved in web development. I saw the process of a small business getting a WordPress site up and running. It was just so many steps and too complicated. I saw a way to really streamline it. Of course, it wasn't completely, you know, groundbreaking or original, really, but it was just a faster, easier way to do the same thing that has already been done before. And so essentially the idea started internally. And I mean, Jordan, like with your businesses, Card Hook and your previous ones, like, would you say it came out of a hunch or from your own experience?
A combination. So while running the e-commerce business, we did use an abandoned cart application, and it was terrible. So that was the beginning of the idea. I wouldn't have even known that abandoned cart applications exist if I didn't run my own e-commerce business. So in that way, it was my own itch. The ability to, you know, the other piece, the seeing a problem and the opportunity to solve it, that I looked to the market for. I looked at, you know, competition, which is a little bit more of the research phase, which is next. But that's one of the first things I like to do. I think it's a really amateur mindset of someone's already doing it, therefore I shouldn't do it. That is it's just completely 180 degrees wrong.
Yeah. And I think, so we'll jump into that in just a moment, but
yeah.
I think so this first idea, and I call this like 10% valid, right? Is the question that you're trying to answer here is this the right idea for me to explore right now?
Right. And is there a market for it? And am I the right person to do it? Can I do it? Do I have a clue on what I'm doing?
Exactly. Because I think all of us have 1,000 different ideas and we see all these different opportunities, but a very few of them are actually in line with where we're at personally, who we have contacts with. I mean, like just today I was at home watching my 11-month-old daughter, and I had a problem that's been bugging me forever. She just walks right up to me and starts banging on my keyboard of my MacBook Pro while I'm trying to type. And sometimes she'll like accidentally like hit send on whatever I'm emailing or something. And so today I took an old diaper box, cardboard box, and I cut it out. So now I made like a little guard for my MacBook Pro. Right. So now like I can just like type away and she can be like, right, like banging up against the side of it.
Universal problem.
Yeah. So I scratched my own itch with that, but am I going to go out and manufacture the ultimate toddler proof MacBook Pro case and sell these to consumers? No, I'm not going to do that. No.
Just because there's an idea doesn't necessarily mean that we're the right people to do it. Yeah. So 37 Signals talks about selling your byproducts. And that sounds to me very much like what WP Bids was, right? You knew you wanted to get this done for your particular process, and this is how you got it done. Will other people find value in doing it the same way? One thing to mention about ideas that I have fallen prey to often is seeing other people have success in solving a problem and saying, I can do that too. That's dangerous. It's really hard to avoid that feeling. But I remember, you know, watching Mixergy interviews and being like, holy shit, this guy's doing what and making how much? And then being all excited and driven to look into that idea for myself. It's usually not a recipe for success.
Yeah.
So that's a bit of a dangerous one to follow.
I think if the idea, like you said, like originates with, oh, that guy's successful, so I'm going to copy exactly what they do, which we see all the time.
Right.
You know,
be careful.
You know, I mean, there are those businesses and they do find moderate success, but they'll never have like the longevity or the integrity that the original business has. And that's not to say, well, like as we get into the next thing here, like doing the research and finding potential competitors, there's a difference between, all right, I'm excited about this idea. I see a need for it. I feel like I'm the right person to solve it. Now I'm going to research it and identify a few competitors. And yes, there are a few competitors, and that's, I think, a good thing. There's a difference between that and like, I have no idea at all. Let me just go see what someone else is doing and rip off everything that they're doing. Right.
Yep. Very, very good distinction. Yeah, let's jump into that second phase, which is research. Okay, once you have an idea, how do you go about looking into it? Right, and this is an art. Being able to dig and find things and go on AngelList and TechCrunch and go back on Hacker News and look at Reddit and search for competitor names, and this is a real art to doing research on potential competitors and potential customers.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, you know, as you start to do this research, you know, you're past the, so you have the idea and you think it has some kind of promise. So you start to Google around and find, you know, potential competitors. Maybe they seem like competitors, but they're not really, or maybe they are direct competitors. You know, so I think that's, I mean, just talking about competitors for a minute, I think that's a good thing. You know, I think in the past, there's been this thing that like that you hear a lot, like if you have an idea and then someone mentions then and you mention it to someone and then they're like, oh yeah, like I know three other companies who do that. There's this and this and this. Like, have you heard of them? You know, and it's like, okay, yeah, I have heard of them, and that's great. I hope there are more people doing it, because it's number one, it shows that there's some kind of market for this. Number two, it elevates the education of the problem and solution as a whole. It more players in the space brings more customers and more education into it.
Yeah, you don't have to educate your potential customers first on your solution. Yeah, the whole concept of being first to an idea, that was 10, 15 years ago, man. That's gone.
Yeah, I would really be a little more worried if it's a completely new, novel, like, invention.
Right, that's unlikely to succeed. Maybe you hit a home run, but it's unlikely. Right, what was it? Google was the 18th or 20th search engine to launch?
Was it? Right? I didn't know that.
Yeah,
I do remember...
Facebook was like the 20th social network to launch.
Yeah, I remember. I do remember the first one that I came across was through AOL, and that was WebCrawler. Yeah, going back.
Yes. So nowadays, seeing a competitor doing well should be taken as a good sign.
Yep.
Right. You want to see a mix. You want to see some crummy competitors. You want to see some really solid competitors. Ideally, a handful, not super saturated, but not sparse either. I think that's the ideal.
And even if there's a big, big funded competitor, I wouldn't necessarily be, you know, afraid of, because you can bring in like the small bootstrapped, scrappy solution, which can be attractive too. Anyway, the other thing that you want to do here in this research phase, as we get to like 20% validated, is you want to start to just get a surface level idea of like some early marketing and customer acquisition ideas. This is something that I kind of failed to do in the past. You know, like when I was launching Restaurant Engine early on, I really did not think too much at all about how I might go about acquiring customers. That was just one of those things like, oh, once I get customers one and two, I'll figure that out. I'll learn and try a bunch of different things. You don't have to necessarily finalize your customer acquisition strategy at this early stage, but thinking about whether or not this is an idea you want to pursue, you want to start looking into, or at least brainstorming different ways. Like, do you have access to this group of customers? How might you go about getting your offer in front of them and that sort of thing?
Yeah, you have to think about that. And that's very related to the big question for this research phase is this the right market for you to enter? Right? That has a lot to do with if you have the ability to reach your potential customers. I was just talking to someone a few days ago. They're in this validation phase. They're looking at an application and a competitor that sells things to schools. And the competitor's doing well, but it doesn't matter if do you think you have access to sell into school systems? And if you don't, if that's too hairy of a problem to tackle, then it doesn't matter these other pieces. That should deter you, or at least make you hesitate on the idea. And I think this far into Restaurant Engine, right? The ability to reach restaurant owners and show them your offering, it's a huge hurdle.
Yeah, I mean, it's a huge challenge for sure. You know, we're continuously working to overcome that challenge. We've been moderately successful in some areas and less successful in other areas, but it's just one of those things that I wouldn't regret doing anything, but I do wish I had spent a little bit more time. I mean, it was just lack of experience really, but I wish I spent more time thinking about the customer acquisition strategy a little bit more in the very, very early days.
Yep, I hear you.
So yeah, moving into that next phase. So this is when I call this like first conversations, and this is getting towards what we call 30% valid, right?
Right. You are not convinced at this point. You are now taking the next step to figure out who are these people? Do they have any interest in this idea at all?
Yeah. If you already have a list or an audience of some sort, maybe if you're coming from a previous product or you've been building an audience, doing content and things, you know, maybe a good start. And if that audience aligns with this idea that you're doing, which I think is a smart thing, you can start by surveying your audience. That is what I did when before I started working on the productized course. That basically started with a survey and then more surveys and conversations. Most people don't necessarily have an audience or a list that they can immediately survey and get those out to.
One of the huge advantages of having an audience.
Yeah. Actually, before I get into this, if you do the survey, alone is not it. You do the survey, you get the results, you get the answers to some very targeted questions. And then based on that, you personally outreach to the people who filled out the survey and then get on the phone with them or Skype with them. So no matter what, your goal here is to get into conversations, 10, yep, 20 plus conversations.
Yeah. This is hustle, man. You have to be willing to get on the phone with strangers and feel weird about it and ask questions and have them be like, who the hell are you again?
Totally.
If you skip this is the single biggest step when you first start talking to strangers on the phone, that will really give you an indication if you're onto something or not. Skipping this is not advisable.
Yeah.
If you do nothing else, do this step.
Do this. If you don't have an email list or an audience to send a survey to, how do you go about getting these conversations started, right? So you can do a cold email campaign. You can just like personally email, 50 plus targeted, like hand-picked target customers who you think would potentially be a good fit. This can also factor into like that 30 by 500 customer research sales safari stuff. You see people out there asking questions on forums, click through to their profiles and dig them up a little bit. And maybe you can, shoot them an email that like, hey, I saw this question that you posted on this forum. I'd love to talk to you about this.
Yeah. This is easier than you expect if you are willing to ignore rejection, because you will get rejected 9 out of 10 times, but those are pretty good odds for getting people on the phone.
Yeah. And we're not saying, email 5 people and expect to have 4 conversations. We're saying email 50 people and expect to have 5-10 conversations out of that.
Yep. And then when you do finally get a chance to talk to someone, ask them for a recommendation who you should talk to next. And it's really the hustle, ground and pound step here that makes the biggest difference. And for me, what I have had success with is cold email, because you can just do it at a bigger scale. And you can ignore rejection very easily because people simply don't respond.
Yeah. I mean, like today, if I'm starting something new today, I would go the cold email route. But that's actually not how I did it back then. And so with Restaurant Engine, what I actually did was I created a very rough landing page. It wasn't even called Restaurant Engine back then. Like a one page. I used like the default WordPress theme, just like pretty much just explained the key benefits of Restaurant Engine, a couple of kind of like fake screenshots in there, sign up for the early to get early access for the beta, enter your email address. And then those people who signed up, I reached out to them and I had about 20 conversations with those people. So nice. That's another way to do it, is run a kind of like a low cost, like AdWords campaign or some kind of PPC campaign at a very rough landing page, and build an early access list. You know, just 100 people is really all you need, and then you know, outreach to them personally and get on the phone.
Yeah, that sounds to me like a better approach. But if you're going to take 3 weeks to set up a landing page and 2 weeks to set up a Facebook PPC campaign, you're probably better off not going that route. If you can get that done in a weekend, hallelujah, do it that way.
Yeah, totally. Yep,
the cold email approach, I think it's worth just me going into for 60 seconds. That I have taken is to find a way to collect email addresses, whether it's you or a VA. Right, I've talked about this before. I did it with appraisers. I went to the Appraisal Institute site. I hired a VA to go and grab the first name and email address of as many, you know, from whatever states I wanted. And it's just out in the open. You can get these appraisers' emails. And then I would load it up into email software like Tout App or Quickmail these days, or SendBloom, whatever it is. And then I would blast out a bunch of emails. Very few people would get back to me, but some people would get back to me. And the email basically said, hey, I'm doing research on this industry. This is who I am. I'm curious about, you know, what you deal with on a day-to-day basis or something to that effect.
Yep.
And then very few people...
Sorry, go on.
I was just going to finish it and say, very few people respond back, but the people who do respond back, you try to get on the phone. And then what you do learn from those few 3, 4, 5 phone conversations, you then synthesize into a few bullet points. And then you send out another email to the very large group. So that's what I did.
Yeah,
so
I like
people
that.
Who just get an email out of nowhere don't respond. But then when you send an email to that same person a week later and say, hey, I've spoken to a bunch of people in your industry, the most common issues they're dealing with are bullet point one, bullet point two, bullet point three. Are you experiencing these? Then you're allowing people to just respond back with a yes, that's my issue also, instead of having it open-ended. And then you'll get a lot more responses. And that's how you can kind of leverage 3 or 4 conversations into getting 20 conversations.
Yeah, very cool. One kind of like quick tip that I always really like to do when I'm doing these customer development conversations is record them. So I use Skype call recorder, and then load them up on your iPhone or on your smartphone and listen back. I can't tell you how helpful this really is, because when you're there live in the conversation, yeah, you're tuning in and you're asking follow-up questions and that's all good. But I can't tell you how many times I listen back to my own conversation with someone and I pick up on little nuances in the conversation. It's like, oh, they really care about that point right there. I didn't realize that in the moment, but that is it. That's their make or break thing. You have all these little insights that you can pick up when you go back and kind of redigest the conversation. So I do recommend recording it. You know, let the person know, like, hey, I'm just going to record this for my own notes, you know. The question that you're trying to answer in this stage as you're doing these first conversations is, do others resonate with this problem solution? And if they do, then who are they? Why does this resonate so much?
What are the characteristics, right, that they have that other people might share?
Yeah, and you know, it's hard to quantify that. It's really more of like a gut feel, but it's, you know, are more of the people talking to you as you start to talk about the solution, it's like, oh yes, I get it. That I totally get it. Maybe they have some questions about it, but they get it. Or are they just like, huh? Like I don't know. Like I'm not getting it.
Right. You can start to see some patterns. You can say, oh, the person who works on their own doing this was really interested. The person who has 5 other employees doing it, they weren't interested at all. And
yep. And
so you could start to get the beginnings of these different hypotheses. Not that they're in concrete with these low numbers, but at least you you can start to sound like you're talking about it next time you talk to people.
Yeah, and you start to build that customer avatar and all that. So okay, so we're moving on. We get that question answered. Like, people are, to our gut instinct, they are resonating with this. We're starting to hear the same kind of trends over and over in these conversations. So now we're feeling a little bit more confident as we go into building a prototype. And now the prototype doesn't necessarily have to be developed or coded. It can be delivered manually. That kind of depends on the nature of the product. I mean, not every product can technically be delivered manually. Like, I think in CartHook, you wouldn't be able to manually recover people's abandoned carts. But there are lots of things that you do manually, for sure. Like, so, you know, I mean, I think in terms of like picking an idea, like personally, that's one of the criteria that I would look for in an idea. Like, can it be delivered manually, at least for a short time, to get to that prototype faster?
Yeah. And if not manually, then at least you can focus on one thing. Yes. Right. If you try to build software for contractors that manages their entire business, maybe that's a good idea, maybe not, but it would definitely be a lot easier to start with one thing. Like, I'm going to really nail proposals for contractors, right? As one part of their process and their flow. And that's where you start for version one.
Yeah.
So anything to simplify and get them value sooner instead of developing this monstrous thing.
Yeah. And like going from the previous step into this one, those conversations that you had with those folks, like maybe your original idea you have ideas for features X, Y, and Z to all come together into this product, right? But in your conversations, you kind of uncover and you learn that like really it's Y, it's feature Y that they actually care so much about. And that's like the make or break thing. And like X and Z are kind of nice to have, you know, not deal breakers. So you can go with that knowledge, that intelligence into this prototype stage and say, all right, the minimum viable product that I'm going to build is just going to do Y, just going to do proposals, you know, whatever it is. And what that does is it gives you enough to put it into the hands of your first test users, you know, because it does the one thing that they actually needed it to do. And so at this stage, I would probably go about doing some kind of free beta, like maybe the same people that I spoke to on those early conversations. I would invite them to start using the prototype. You know, I'll install it for you. I'll walk you through it, or I'll watch you do it or something like that. Very, very closely monitoring this and getting their feedback and actually seeing if it works, you know, because the question that we're trying to answer here in this prototype stage is, do customers actually get value from this prototype? Wait, like we've talked about it, it resonates with them. They say they want it. Now let's actually see them use it and see them get the value that they're invested for.
Yeah. The only thing I would differ on is I would try not to make it free as the beta. It might be so rough that you really can't charge for it, but I would do whatever possible to have it paid. And I think the other option that's in this prototype stage, especially if you are not a developer and do not have the resources to go out and spend $5,000-$10,000 on building a prototype, is you could just deliver almost like a dummy app, right? So this is what I've done. This is also what Dane teaches in the foundation, where those first conversations that you have give you an indication of what to build. But then before building, you basically can just build something using like Envision or using any type of like balsamic, something to that effect that visually represents the problem being solved. And then basically just using that as your prototype and saying, is this what you mean? Is this doing what you expect it to do? And basically just having no engineering and no code in back of it. Just if you click on this button, this other screenshot appears. If you click on this button, this other screenshot appears, which is like the half prototype, not a functioning prototype, but some people might need it as an in-between if they don't have the resources or knowledge to build it themselves.
Yeah. I mean, like at this stage in terms of like free versus paid, I would consider asking them to pay for something on day one of using the prototype. To me, that's kind of like pre-selling in a little bit. I mean, you're very close, but it's in a way, like what I'm thinking here is like the very next step that we have here is get money from from customers who are using it. Right. But this is kind of like a short period of time where it's like, let's just, because we know that there are going to be bugs. We know that there are going to be issues with like how we solved this problem. Let's get it into the hands of like 10, 20 free beta users who are highly engaged and agreed to like help me develop this product, and for a couple of weeks kind of watch them use it. And then as we get into that next that next phase here, the question is like, is anyone willing to pay for this? You go to those free users who are clearly getting the value from it and say, okay, you've received this value from it. Are you ready to become a paying customer? And what will likely happen is not all of them will. I mean, maybe they were just kicking the tires or whatever, but some of them probably will, assuming that they're getting that value.
Yeah. So yeah, I think we're not as far apart on it as I originally thought, because this prototype before asking for payment might or might not actually work. It might just be screenshots. If you have the ability to build something very simple or to deliver it manually, whatever it is, you want the customers to get value from it. Even if it's just screenshots that they click and the next screenshot comes up and they say, oh my God, if I could actually do this, this would solve my problem. So that's really the right question to focus on.
Yeah.
Is this resonating? Right.
I think this is a step that can actually be that that wall that shuts everything down, because even if you have those conversations with customers and they tell you, yeah, that's a burning problem, I'm resonating with that, and the solution sounds great, you know, a lot of times customers don't know what they actually want or they actually need, and then when it comes down to it and they start using it, it's like, oh, actually, it's not quite.
Right, or that means I have to stop using this other thing. I don't want to do that. Or
yeah, all of a sudden, like new objections, or just the problem doesn't seem as important as it was before. So like, these are the kinds of things that can crop up in this prototype phase, and that might cause you to reassess and go back to square one. You know, or it is providing the value as expected, maybe with a few tweaks. And you can move on to the next phase, which is paying customers, getting your very first like 1, 2, 3 paying customers.
Yeah, the business before Cardhook, the idea before Cardhook, I shut down at the prototype stage. And thank God, it's a lot better to shut it down at that stage than to get any more into it. So that whole appraiser thing I talked about, I went through this whole thing. And I had conversations and I had meetings. And I built the screenshot prototype and showed it to people. And then these new objections came up. And they said, oh, that's amazing, but I also needed to do this. But how is it going to work along with this other thing? And it just kind of got to the point where I wasn't anywhere close to delivering the value. And I shut it down at this stage. And it's better off.
Yeah. And I remember with Restaurant Engine, I did do like a free beta. The people who had signed up for that early access list, if I remember correctly, I think there was something like 120 people on the list, and about 60, 65 of them signed up and started like creating websites with Restaurant Engine for free. And I ran that for about 2 or 3 months. And then at the end of that free beta period, I announced to all of them, you can lock in a 20% discount to become a paying customer. And 6 of those people became our first 6 paying customers. So, I mean, that does go to show awesome. That a large portion of those people who are using it for free just won't convert, even if they're using it.
They weren't getting enough value out of it, right?
That's
it. Cool. So now we're getting to the fun stuff.
Yep.
Money, paying customers, the real sign of somebody else getting value from your product. Right, the real validation that you're looking for, that up until now you have tried to maximize your chances of getting to this point, right? All those other steps before this lead up to, okay, somebody's willing to pay money because they think it's worth it.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, I'm calling this like 50% valid, which even though you have a couple of paying customers, that it's easy to think that, okay, that's validated. We've got paying customers. You know, 1 or 2, 3 paying customers, you know, I think it's a lot easier to get 1 or 2 people to pay for something than to get a sustainable value where lots and lots of customers will eventually come on. There's a difference there. And that's how we get into these next steps.
Yeah, I think that's smart. You know, at first I hear that, I'm like, but if they're paying, then it's validated. And the truth is, you know, that's not right. If I look back at Cardhook, I didn't consider Cardhook validated until a few months ago. Because only once you get these other pieces in place can you really say, okay, this is a business, and now I should do the things that a business deserves, all this automation, all these other things to go beyond it. So I think that's smart. The payment,
right,
a piece of validation, but not fully validated.
Yeah. I mean, it's a huge milestone to get over for sure.
Yeah.
There's no doubt about it. But
yeah.
Yeah. I mean, is this a, it's one thing to be like, all right, I landed one person who's willing to pay for this. It's another thing to say, this is a viable business and it's ready to grow.
Yeah. It's definitely a great milestone. You know, go out during lunch, have a beer, you know, look up into the sky, be happy with yourself for a few minutes before you start coming down hard on yourself again. Yeah. Then it's time to get to work.
Yeah. And so now we get into this next phase, which I call like sustained value, 60% valid, right? So now the question is, are those first customers willing to stick around? Like if it's a SaaS subscription model, then will they actually continue to month two, month three without canceling? Or is, you know, is churn, is cancellation going to be an issue? Like, is every paying customer going to cancel before month two? I mean, that's a real question, because there could be very serious objections, or maybe the value works for a couple of days and then for whatever reason, the nature of the product, it kind of tapers off.
This is the sustained value question reminds me of that talk from Jason Cohen about the perfect bootstrap business and how the if the nature of the product and the problem is such that it delivers value constantly over time, you're in an infinitely better situation. I think I can think of one recurring service I use right now. It's very expensive. I pay for it for 1 month. I extract all the value I need out of it and I shut it down.
Yeah.
It's not because I'm a bad guy. It's because I'm human and I'm rational. So yeah, this is a real concern.
I think of like event-based stuff. Like if you're selling something to, you know, couples who are having a wedding,
right?
The wedding comes and goes, you know, and that's it.
Right. A website for your restaurant, that you need that at all times on an ongoing basis.
Yeah. And that's the other thing about sustained value is it's one thing if it's it can be a tool and it can give you sustained value, but only if the customer uses it, like actively goes into it and extracts the value from it every single month. Or it can be a tool that maybe it has a little bit of setup in the beginning, but then it's like set it and forget it, and it continues to bring in value. And you know, there's whether it's a productized service or just like an automated tool or product or something that just the customer doesn't have to be active, and things can come up with the customer and they can get distracted, but the thing still makes them more money or saves them time or whatever it does.
Yep. And that is best represented by people not leaving.
Yeah.
By people consciously, you know, some people forget and this and that, and I have services that I should cancel. But your paying customers sticking around month after month, that's what you're looking for.
Yeah. And I mean, in terms of like actionable things that you can do, because this is a process, like you're going to need to work through getting those first customers to stay, because there will be some who inevitably cancel. So I think it's important that you as the founder are manning the support desk in the early days, doing the live chat, doing the email. You're the one who's on the front lines, hearing every one of those issues that come up, or hearing those objections that come up. You know, that kind of helps you know, all right, now that we've built this core minimum product, what are the next few holes in this bucket that we need to fix?
Yeah, and if you do have that validation, if people are sticking around, maybe it's not perfect, but there are people who are getting value on a consistent basis that don't leave you and are happy to pay you, then you're a good way toward a validated business. The next step is, can you acquire customers on a scale larger than just, hey, I'm the founder and you saw me in an interview and you reached out to me and now you give the free trial a try. It has to be more repeatable.
Yeah, totally. This gets into the next phase here, customer acquisition. We're getting up to like 70-80% validated here as a viable business. Here, we're starting to test repeatable customer acquisition channels. Like you said, it's one thing to just kind of like hack and claw your way up to you know, a handful of paying customers, and you right. can do that forever, but you'll run out of days of your life if you do it that way. Here you're looking for those scalable, repeatable processes, whether it's running paid acquisition or you know, content marketing or ongoing email outreach, perhaps, you know, just different things.
Yeah, something that gives you a sign of hope that if you did it this month and it worked to a certain extent, if you did it next month, it would work to a certain extent again, and then you can try to improve it and you can keep doing it. I think the scrappiness is necessary and it should be the focus in the beginning. You have to be able to claw your way to 10, 20, 30 clients.
Yep.
If you can't do that, then it's unlikely that other things are going to work out and the more scalable acquisition is going to work out. So I think it's great to focus on that the early scrappiness and directly finding people on LinkedIn and messaging them and emailing them and seeing, you know, I remember looking at like the Inc. 500. I go to the retail e-commerce section and I find stores and I send them an email. I say, congrats on being included in the Inc. 500. You guys are awesome. You know, I'd love to talk. Here's what I'm working on. I used to run an e-commerce store. If you can't do that stuff at conferences and all that to get your first paying customers, you're in trouble.
Yeah. And like as a bootstrapper, you're self-funding this whole thing. So you do need paying customers in the beginning just to give you a little bit of cash flow, to give you a little bit of runway to then test things like paid acquisition or and you know, doing other methods. Like if you're just going to skip the manual dirty work of getting those first customers and try to jump straight into, testing these scalable customer acquisition strategies, then you can run out of money very fast before you get enough data to figure out what's working and what's not.
Yeah, it's interesting to look at these different pieces and compare them on a scale. I put them on a scale of stages of the company. Right, and maybe I would say up until this piece, this customer acquisition piece, the ideal is to self-fund. The ideal is to get this up and running on your own, maybe another person, really lean and mean and quick. And this customer acquisition piece is the first time that outside money might make a difference. Like yeah. if you just have an idea, like don't whether it's friends or family or your own money, it doesn't really make sense to put money toward it. This customer acquisition piece is the first time where you say, we've figured out all these things, people are paying, people are sticking around, they're getting real value from it. Now let's take a little bit of money and see if we can acquire people on a more consistent basis. And if you can, then you're starting to get into that last step, 100% validation, and that we'll call funnel optimization. So yeah. You have a product that delivers value, and now you're going to optimize how to get people from being strangers into that product, deliver them value, and then have them pay you for that value on an ongoing basis.
Yeah, I mean, like building that. So you've tested a bunch of marketing channels, customer acquisition channels. You found one or two or three that work. Now it's really optimizing that funnel and making it a predictable revenue stream. And then once you have that, it's about how can we actually grow this? We know the engine that will grow it. What are the steps that we need to take, whether it's funding or, you know, continuing to self-fund, but double down and get the optimizations in place and grow it.
Right. That's the time to put capital and resources toward it, whether it's your own or other people's. Once you've figured out all these other things, and you figured out a way, a place, a channel to acquire customers at a reasonable or efficient or whatever you want to call the amount of money you need to pay for each customer, then you can feel confident in putting money toward it because it should keep coming back in the same way, and then you can optimize it and make it better. So that's yeah. Then you have a business.
Yeah, and you know, you can be listening to this and thinking like, well, if you get to that point, if you get that far along, like, are you really still in the validation process, right? And I think in a way you are, because you can bring a business to a certain point and then kind of run up against this friction of like, well, how much farther can we take it? Or what are the necessary next steps to, or what does this look like in the next phase of this business? And like, maybe, you know, it's just not the right fit for you at this stage or given the current circumstance or whatever. Like, you know, maybe it's valid and viable for you as the founder for a while, and then it's not at a certain point.
But, yeah, I think it's right. I think it's right. If I look back at my e-commerce business, I was between these two stages. I was between 70 and 100% validated. And the truth is, the reason that we sold the business is because it wasn't a great business. If it was a great business, we wouldn't have let it go. But it wasn't 100% validated as a great business, right? We figured out all these pieces. We figured out how to acquire customers at scale. We put resources toward it. We grew it to 60, 65K a month in revenue. But the truth is, it wasn't optimized. It wasn't a great business. And that's what brought us to, hey, you know what? Maybe we should unload this thing and sell to somebody who has a better situation for it. Yeah, yeah. And I guess that really means it was not 100% validated. Even at 65K a month, it was not validated as a great business. And we let it go and sold it, not because, you know, someone was throwing eight figures at us. It's because it wasn't a great business and it was the right time to unload it and take money off the table.
Yeah, and maybe it's, you know, it's just not a great business for you at that time, but for someone else, it can be a huge opportunity, or it could fit perfectly within their existing infrastructure or something, you know, like,
yep.
It's a good question to think about.
Right. It's the asset had value, but it wasn't a great business for us.
Yep. Cool. Well, that about wraps it up. Sounds like we've validated an idea from start to finish. That was easy.
Oh yeah. No problem.
By the way, all of this, you should be able to run through it in about a week.
Yeah, a week or two.
Yeah.
No big deal.
Easy.
I think looking back at everything we talked about, the single most important thing for me is getting people on the phone. Getting strangers on the phone.
Yeah.
People that don't know you and talking about their business and what you're considering solving and getting feedback on whether or not this thing makes any sense to them. I think that's the best thing you can do out of all this stuff.
Yeah, I do agree there. I think for me, it took me a little while to get on the phone and feel comfortable with that. And like, even in the early days of Restaurant Engine, I got on the phone with those first early access subscribers. But even that, it was like begrudging, you know, like I did maybe five or six conversations. And then after that, I was like, all right, I'm just doing it because people on Mixer G tell me to do it. And I'm not, you know, I didn't really put the emphasis that I should have. But I mean, things kind of worked out. But then even in the first year, I stuck so much to doing like email and live chat when I should have been getting on the phone at any chance I could. And then once I started doing that, it really worked.
It works. Yeah. I've had the same experience. At the beginning, I talked to everybody as much as I possibly could. And then I went away from that a little bit. And things were not as good. And then recently, I started reaching out and asking existing customers to get on the phone. And then all of a sudden, you just start to learn a lot more. You start to, yeah, get help on where you should focus, what features you should build. Yeah, those conversations over the phone.
Totally. Well, should we wrap it up?
We should. I hope this has been helpful to people. You know, thinking about ideas, there's a lot of resources all over the place online. This is kind of our take on it, and our personal experience, and our knowledge of these different systems. So, just hope it was helpful.
Yeah, and we'd love to hear from you guys. What's working for you? What's not working for you? Where are you having trouble with this kind of stuff? You could leave us a comment on the blog post, or even better, leave it as tell us what you think in a review on iTunes, or just ping us on Twitter. So. Yeah, and with that, as always, you can go to bootstrappedweb.com. That's where you'll find this blog post and all of the archives for the show. And we will talk to you guys next week.
Good stuff. Talk to you soon.
All right. Later, everyone.